From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, we'll see how things are going for one Michigan renter off the job since March.
What's going to happen is that when this pandemic goes beyond July and people aren't receiving that extra $600 a week anymore. Because, I mean, before that, I had only been approved for $200 from unemployment. I definitely, $200 a week would not have paid my bills.
Also, a landlord in Detroit talks about staying courageous during the pandemic.
If you see an opportunity for correction, challenge yourself not to revert back to a comfortable reaction, but choose to learn from the experience and bring your innovations.
And we have updates in the case of a man accused of sexually abusing children in Michigan. Until this month, no charges had been filed.
And another complaint with a totally different family has come forward that happened the same year that the Barretts and this story really unfolded.
Those stories and more just ahead on today's Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Later this hour, we revisit the latest about a man accused by multiple Michigan families of sexually abusing children. Prosecutors had not taken any action against him, but new allegations have surfaced. We'll get the latest update from Michigan Radio's Lindsay Smith later on. But first, we're now more than 2 months into Michigan's coronavirus crisis. And as the weeks have passed, we've been thinking about some of the people we've spent time with whose lives were thrown into chaos by the pandemic. All over Michigan, renters are entering a critical stage. With only a few sectors of the economy getting back online, rent coming due, and the governor's eviction ban scheduled to sunset May 15th. Crystal Michelle Brasseur is a student who lives in Detroit. Until recently, she was a server at the Monarch Club, a high-end restaurant. And like millions of other people, she has not been able to work since March. We wanted to call her to hear about what's going on. Crystal, welcome back to Stateside.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So how are you doing?
Well, I've been doing a lot better than a lot of other people I know in my situation, I feel like.
Yeah. Have you been able to find other work?
I haven't been able to find other work, but I'm actually one of the very lucky few who's been able to get approved by unemployment and actually receive funds.
What's your secret?
Wake up at 6 a.m. and call them until 8.
That was how you did it. Was keeping at it. Can I ask how much help those payments have been? Again, you worked in the service industry, and I know sometimes unemployment doesn't take into account, the tips that are really the staple of servers' wages.
Yeah, I definitely, without the unemployment pandemic assistance, I think without that, I wouldn't have been able to survive. I'd probably be living back with my mom. But because of the extra $600 that we're receiving a week, because, again, I don't have children except for, like, my cats, I live in a very cheap, small studio apartment, I'm able to, like, stay pretty comfortable and afloat right now. But I know a lot of other people who are in my scenario who don't have the same, I guess, situations going on aren't even anywhere close to feeling secure like I do right now.
Now, the last time we talked, your landlord didn't sound extra ready to negotiate. Has there been any change in the tone of those conversations?
Well, not entirely. It's kind of the same. What they have changed is they're actually, they've taken away any fees that are associated with a late fee, given that you're already up to date on your rent. I think it's like a $100 late fee if you don't pay your bills and all that stuff. So that's really the only change that I've seen. Other than that, they just are reaching out to people and saying, well, if you need to create a payment plan, we can create a payment plan. But I don't think it's really anything else beyond that.
But rent is still due.
Yeah, rent is definitely still due. They remind us of that.
Do you know if anybody else in your building is in trouble with that?
You know, I'm actually not aware. I hardly ever leave my little unit. I haven't really talked to very many people. I've talked to my maintenance guy a few times, and I think he's doing okay. I worry about him because he's a little bit older, and I worry about how he's going to be doing with all this and how they're treating him. But for the most part, it seems like most people are just staying in their unit, and I haven't, at least on my floor, I haven't noticed any notices on people's doors or anything like that. So I don't think they're being progressive at all if they are potentially kicking people out. I think they must be doing it under the hush because I haven't seen anything.
Crystal, when we talked, you said that you were pursuing an education degree at Wayne State University. What's going on with that? Have you been able to take any online classes, or are you just putting things on hold for now?
For right now, things are on hold. I did finish the last of my semester. I'm not sure how long things are going to have to be on hold. And that's really the big thing that's up in the air right now, is that I did get accepted to finish the second part of my program, which is like a internship that I would be doing in a school. But I'm not exactly sure what that's going to look like in the fall.
Does that feel like something that would be safe to do, getting into the classroom?
No. Not if we don't have a vaccine or anything going on. I don't know if it would be safe.
What if the school was doing some sort of hybrid or online learning situation? Would you feel better about that?
I don't know. How can you have a hybrid learning situation when you have students that are in public education don't all have access to Wi-Fi or computers? That, to me, seems very nice for people who are from an upper middle class and have money and are able to do that kind of learning, and there are parents that are able to stay home with their students. But, I mean, if I was an educator right now, I wouldn't even want to take on a student teacher if that was the situation. If I had to do a hybrid class with my juniors who are barely showing up to school as it is, and now I have to teach a student, like a college student, how to be a teacher in these times, and I don't even know what I'm doing as a teacher, I don't know.
Is there anything else that's been on your mind that I didn't ask you about?
No, you kind of covered it. Just like, what is school going to look like in the future?
Yeah, for sure.
You know, because for me right now, that's really the biggest fear. And also, too, of what's going to happen is it when this pandemic goes beyond July and people aren't receiving that extra $600 a week anymore. Because, I mean, before that, I had only been approved for $200 from unemployment. I definitely $200 a week would not have paid my bills, let alone anyone else's.
Crystal, thank you so much for talking to us about your situation, and we'll check back in with you this summer and see what's new.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for calling, April.
Crystal Michelle Brasseur is a student at Wayne State University who lives in Detroit. Renters aren't the only ones in uncharted territory right now. Property owners and lenders are too. Now that we're a few months into the governor's stay-at-home order, we wanted to check back in with Owen Lee. He's the co-owner and CEO of Success Mortgage Partners in Plymouth, Michigan. Owen Lee, welcome back to Stateside.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Hey, the last time we talked, you mentioned something that really stuck with me. You said it's very important to stay in touch with your lender. If folks think they're not going to be able to make a payment, it's just important to get that out there up front, that lenders will want to know sooner rather than later. Would you say that that happened?
I think it's happening with most people. When Congress passed the CARES Act, there was some pretty liberal language in there about the ability to have mortgage forbearance. And mortgage forbearance has been authorized for those affected by the COVID virus, either economically or health-wise. You can get mortgage forbearance for somewhere between 3 and 12 months, depending upon your circumstances. But it is very important to talk to your mortgage servicer about that, because if you don't call them, the forbearance is not automatic. And what happens to you and your credit history varies greatly. If you just don't make your payment, the rules are the same. They're not going to assume forbearance. They're going to assume that you're in default. They're going to report to the credit bureaus that reality, and it will significantly harm your credit.
Oh, and maybe we should take a minute and talk about what forbearance means.
Forbearance is not forgiveness. Those payments and that money that's owed from the borrower to the mortgage company do not go away. They can be temporarily suspended while you're in forbearance, but part of the process is discussing how those payments are going to be made up. Everybody, I would encourage them to have a conversation with their mortgage servicer about what that might look like if you're considering forbearance. There are several plans out there. The number one plan is to try and collect all the payments at the end of the forbearance period, which obviously is not great for the vast majority of borrowers that enter forbearance. There are some double payment options to catch people up, and there are some options to place some of that liability toward the end of the mortgage. But I think what's different now from what was prescribed back in the 2008 to 2012 period is the option to just automatically take those payments and place them at the end of the mortgage is not nearly as readily available as it was in the past. So it's very important that the borrowers understand the financial impact of a forbearance and how it's going to affect them as they come out of the forbearance, and use that information to make the best decision for them and their family as they decide whether to take advantage of what was prescribed in the CARES Act or not.
Now, folks may be aware that mortgages are almost certainly, after you sign a mortgage, they're sold to other companies that service the mortgage over the time of the loan. That's referred to as the secondary market. Can you give us a sense of what's going on, just a brief overview of what's happening in the secondary market right now?
The appetite for mortgages on the secondary market is still very strong. That's helped greatly by the Federal Reserve. Beginning really in earnest the week of March 23rd, the Federal Reserve started to purchase billions of dollars worth of mortgages, referred to on that market as mortgage-backed securities. They're really the biggest buyer out there right now. They're still purchasing somewhere between $30 and $40 billion a week as we speak. That has had a tremendous stabilizing effect on the market. Interest rates are still very low. They've stayed very low. Most of the interest rates that our company is doing is somewhere in the mid threes. You can get down to the low threes depending upon your credit history and the type of loan that you want to get. The refinance activity is very strong. The purchase activity is down about 30 to 40%. But that's due mostly to the various governors' stay-at-home orders or shelter-in-place orders has really had a chilling effect on real estate sales. Although even real estate sales have been strong considering the environment in which they're operating. But the demand for new mortgages on the secondary market is still very strong.
Owen, thank you so much. We appreciate your time.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Owen Lee of Success Mortgage Partners in Plymouth. You've heard from a tenant and a lender. The last piece of the puzzle here is landlords, some of whom are wondering if they'll be able to keep tenants who are struggling to make the rent and still get their own mortgages taken care of. We'll speak with one of them after the break. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Before the break, we were talking with one renter from the Detroit area and one mortgage broker who was talking about changes in the industry and what COVID-19 has brought to the relationship between rent payers, property owners, and lenders. With us now is Andre Watson. He owns several rental properties in the city of Detroit, and we called him up to ask him what's going on with him and his relationships. Andre, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Will you tell me a little bit about the properties you own?
Yeah, just regular residential properties in the city of Detroit, few outside of the city, but predominantly in the city, and I've owned them for several years. I've always tried to create a special relationship with my tenants. It's not always been easy, but yeah, that's been my approach to renting.
What was on your mind in March when Governor Whitmer put stay-at-home restrictions in place that shut down most people's form of income?
First and foremost, it was just a matter of general concern about health first. It was the first time where we had to go to our human trait first, not just the arrangement as landlord-tenant. And I just wanted to make sure everybody was safe and okay. That was the first thought. And then I started to hear rumblings about the concern about people's inability to get to their jobs, or even just a general, you know, fear, or even the thought of just not paying rent. And so that, you know, of course, alerted me to my landlord part, where I guess I kind of realized that it's the solution has to be one of give and take. That was the first instinct.
Do you know if any of the folks living in your properties had health concerns related to the virus?
Yes, I do. No, they have not, thank God. But one is a senior, and she's really worked up about the whole experience, and mm-hmm. It's been very trying on her.
So What have you been in a position to do for tenants right now? Are you in a place where you have to ask them to pay their rent every month, or is there any wiggle room possible in terms of your situation?
Yeah, I just use each case individually. If there's been displacement of jobs, or if there are any programs that I hear of where they can get assistance that they may need, then I, you know, forward information. I keep the communication lines open. That's the one thing I really press and stress with them, to stay communicating with me, because we can get through it no matter what. So I do leave room in case they can't pay. But if they're able to, I'd expect them to. But at the same time, you know, this is just the beginning of this. So this whole dance that we're doing with our tenants, it will become a norm. There'll be further displacement for other reasons.
When you first became a landlord, did you ever imagine that you might be in a situation where people would be out of work for so long and you'd have to negotiate a situation like this?
No, never. As a landlord, no. As a citizen, I never thought we would experience anything that touched to this extent. So no, never.
Tell me a little bit about what you've heard from people about their situation, the things that they're doing to make ends meet or to try to make sure they can get you some money when rent is due.
There are several programs. I was pretty impressed with the way the city of Detroit had a very responsive system, not only with being somewhat cutting edge with national notoriety and testing. Not all the way there where we need to be, by no means, but still, I thought it was pretty impressive to see the mayor's response. And so a lot of these programs I would forward to my tenants, and I'd also engage them about their employment during this time, and first and foremost, how they're doing. But I'd also keep them empowered, because we do have to come out of this to some form of normalcy. So I'm appreciative of the resources that I have seen thus far.
Andre, have you had to talk to any lenders about the schedule for your payments on your properties?
Yes, I have. I was proactive there because I thought that maybe a buffer that I could then utilize to better take care of the relationships with the tenants in case there, you know, some of the payments will need to be missed. So I figured I would try to grab that comfort of knowing that I could have some level of reprieve, and then that could translate to the tenant and give them a buffer as well. And everybody can be okay for a while.
How receptive did you find lenders to making some kind of arrangement?
Oddly enough, the larger ones, very receptive and very professional and engaging. The smaller lenders were a little bit still almost going for that payment. And you could tell the difference. I normally the larger, you know, lenders, you would expect to have pushback and resistance, but they were very receptive. The smaller ones that I deal with, they weren't. So I'm still working with a few of them there.
What would you say the biggest concerns are on your mind at the moment?
Biggest concerns is, what sense of normalcy will we eventually land with? And more importantly, the anxieties that people are experiencing. From dealing with tenants and the general public for a living, you get to leverage and learn how different people's lives are. And so like the senior tenant, her anxieties were so high. So I don't even know what her experiences in a form of normalcy will be. And then it's magnified by the disproportionate of African Americans, because some of my tenants are African American. And the disproportionate of African Americans, so they're experiencing death, inability to mourn, commonly first line as it relates to jobs where you can't leave your home. So it was pretty intense, I'd say.
One of the producers who works on our show, Laura Weber Davis, once heard you say that Detroit is like a pressure cooker, and that the people who live in the city, Black residents, can only take so much downward and inward pressure from the systems around them, systems that were built to foster inequity and racism, and that filters into housing. How would you say what's happening with the pandemic either does or doesn't play into the pressure cooker that already exists in Detroit?
Yeah, before we spoke of the systemic racism that has created a lot of this, you know, this pressure, if you will. And so I think with the whole virus scare and the disproportionate amounts of death, which is you know, largely due to the circumstances of individuals within the city, which is actually out of their control, largely, because I just think it makes it even worse. And I hate to see like a double victimization occurring, but I do suspect that unless we stay courageous and alert, even during an emergency, that we will. You'll see a double amount of stress. Beyond that, you know, people are experiencing real-time death and exaggerations, you know, with high amount of people dying and not able to mourn and still not knowing how to function. So I really do pray that we as Americans choose to be better and actually take all of the valuable lessons that we can from this experience, because we can help systems while improving how we exist as a society. But if we go into denial, that would be the real threat.
I wanted to ask you about the governor's ban on evictions, which right now is scheduled to sunset later this week. I was wondering what that ban has meant for you and whether you think it should be continued.
I think that ban was very appropriately done. It was really disturbing to see the overreaction. And I, by the way, I do believe in free enterprise, and I do believe in for-profits, you know, stances. But I believe her position was very appropriate due to the severity of what we were suffering from as a state. And I also believe that the overreaction could be consequential, because I do believe we're in an experiment as far as a solution for the coronavirus. This is an experiment, so we have to observe it to see if it's actually worked or not. I think her being that absolute in what she was challenging us to do was really for our own good.
The point at which a landlord is willing to consider an eviction obviously varies a lot per the situation. But have any situations with your tenants gotten to the point where under different circumstances you would have been pursuing legal action?
Yes. Some tenants had not been able to pay for several months, or really so 2 months. But as long as they keep the lines of communications open, I'll work with them. And also the displacement of eviction is so harsh economically on tenants or individuals, and then it trickles to the children. So as the landlord, we have to be responsible and challenge ourselves to go to a more, you know, a difficult place. But it's so consequential when you do an eviction, especially in a time where economic uncertainty is so high. It's just something I think it's a time for everyone to step up.
What does that mean? You said earlier it's important for us to stay courageous. What does that mean to you in the moment?
It means that if you see an opportunity for correction, challenge yourself not to revert back to a comfortable reaction, but choose to learn from the experience. And if poverty is something that you're staring at, you know, bring your innovations. Or even if households are challenged to stay more mindful of their spending, you know, absorb the lessons. I think it would be a tragedy if we only went back to how we were pre-coronavirus. I think we all have received valuable intel that allows us to be refined as a society, and then also a reminder of our levels of vulnerability, even in our existence, you know. So I think they're valuable lessons, and prayerfully we'll never experience something like this, but some of the lessons are very, very powerful.
I've heard an old saying, never let a crisis go to waste.
That's right. I believe in that.
You know, a lot of us look to our landlords as people who are more financially secure, and we think to ourselves, surely they've got the resources to, you know, to help me out. Does a situation like that scare you, where your own vulnerability maybe isn't the first thing on tenants' minds?
It does. It's very concerning. And that's that whole integrity part where I value myself in not just creating a very mechanical relationship with tenants, but I pray that they too understand it's not just an easy experience for landlords as well. And I think, you know, policy and how we interact with tenants, we need to leave room for an awareness on both sides. Heavy-handed policies or that could be, you know, affecting landlords, or, you know, abuse or mistreatment of tenants. Both we have to be cautious to.
How are you coping with fear right now?
Fear is manifesting for me with action. I've gone through, you know, my grief of whatnot, and now I need action, because as an African-American, I don't want to be a victim of this virus. So a proactive stance and being creative and trying to stay mindful of how will I function going forward is where I'm pouring my energies to. Because I think it's even more threatening to continue to stay in the victim, in the victimization posture, you know, as it relates to this virus. We have to do things and we will have to push through. So that's how I'm seeing it now.
Andre Watson owns several rental properties in Detroit and Metro Detroit. Andre, thank you for talking to us today. And we really do wish you and your tenants the best right now.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Today, we received word that another of Michigan's state officials has died from the coronavirus. Former state senator Morris Hood III of Detroit passed away after several weeks in intensive care. As the son of another former lawmaker, Mo Hood III distinguished himself during his turn in the legislature as a kind and thoughtful man. Let's listen to him during a floor speech honoring a fallen police officer back in 2018.
Just take a moment and say thank you to the people, not only the people that protect us, just people, period. Open up your hearts, open up your minds, open up your souls, because tomorrow's not promised. And we pray for the Doss family for their unfortunate loss. But we also pray for us, people, to do the right thing, to love one another, to care for one another, and as God says, forgive one another. Because we all make mistakes. We all have done things that we regret, said something to a loved one that we regret, but go back and forgive them. Reach out to them. Love is the greatest thing that we have in this world. Love one another. Thank you, Madam President.
Mo Hood III was 54 years old. Zach Gorchow covered Mo Hood III in the legislature for several years, and he joins us now to talk more about him. Zach, welcome back to Stateside.
Thank you for having me.
Do you remember meeting Mo Hood?
Well, yes. I remember thinking, you know, what was Morris Hood III going to be like? Because I knew, you know, I had briefly covered his father, Morris Hood Jr., 28-year state representative who was a giant of the Capitol. And, you know, as a college reporter, when I was covering him, I was quite intimidated by, because he was such a towering figure. So I wondered, what was Morris Hood III going to be like? And one of the things I quickly realized was, you know, what a kind, bright person this was, who, you know, had an understanding of how to deal with people, whether that was a reporter or a staff or other legislators. And, you know, it was quickly clear this was going to be someone who was going to stand on his own two feet. This was not somebody who was just there because he had the same name as someone who served before him. This was somebody with a lot of talent and ability on their own.
Yeah, Lansing is not always the kind of place where success comes synonymously with cordiality. How do you think he was able to keep what he needed to do on track while still maintaining those relationships?
I think he's sort of old school in that respect, that you could fight like hell on an issue, but know how to relate and get along and care about your political opponents or adversaries on an issue afterward, that once you stepped off the field, so to speak, you know, I think he, you know, for the most part, when it came to most of the people he served with, that he believed they were trying to help the state, even if they had complete opposite ways of going about that. And it just shined through that he could deliver a very withering speech, caustic even, about something that the Republican majorities were doing in the Senate. But yet, you know, today I saw many Republican senators, you know, quite an outpouring of condolences and grief, showing that they really care deeply about him and respected him.
How do you think he'll be remembered in Lansing?
I think he'll be remembered as just a really good person, a champion for Detroit, somebody who understood the legislative process and how to work it, and above all, stayed so grounded and seemed to care about everyone he came in contact with. I saw one well-known lobbyist today tweeted, to know Mo Hood was to like him. And I can't really put it any better than that.
Zach Gorchow is executive editor and publisher of Gong War of Michigan. You can read his remembrance of Mo Hood on the Gong War website. Zach, thank you so much for your time and the memories.
Thank you.
After the break, an update on an investigative report involving a man who was a member of a celibate evangelical brotherhood. He's been accused of sexually abusing several Michigan children.
Another complaint with a totally different family has come forward that happened the same year that the Barretts and this story really unfolded.
That's next on Stateside. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today we're revisiting a story we first brought you in January of this year about Jamie Treadwell, a self-professed celibate man, part of a Christian evangelical group in Chelsea. Treadwell is accused of sexually abusing young girls. Today we have a big update for you on this story, but first, let's listen to the original reporting by Michigan radio reporter Lindsay Smith. And just a warning, this story does contain a fair amount of disturbing content and may not be appropriate for all listeners.
4 years ago, Rob Barrett gets a phone call from a new friend of his.
Hey, I want to do some snow sculpture. Could the girls do some snow sculpture with me?
Rob's new friend is Jamie Treadwell. He's a tall, slim, balding white guy. In 2016, he made friends with Rob and his wife, Crystal Barrett. Back then, Treadwell is a 58-year-old artist, life coach, world traveler, a man of faith.
He comes over, and next thing you know, there's this Moses in our front yard.
I've got pictures that they've been. The whole neighborhood was totally impressed.
It's not just a snowman, it's a sculpture. Moses holding his hand up in the air, pointing to the heavens. And all this, and it is astounding.
I had neighbors texting me, were like, holy cow, how
did you know there's a Moses
do that? What in the world is, you know?
Jamie Treadwell is like a big kid. That's how the Barretts' daughters would later describe him to police. So nice, so fun. When it warms up in the spring, Treadwell asks to wash his car at their house. Starts a big water fight with the girls.
They were really, really, really liked him. I mean, like, really liked him.
A few months into their friendship, Treadwell is at the Barretts' house at least a couple times a week. Sometimes he just pops by, unannounced. When it is planned, Treadwell shows up super early. Rob wouldn't be home from work yet, and Crystal notices Treadwell always disappears with her girls into areas of the house or backyard she cannot see.
Then I would go and find them, and they were almost always playing some kind of a game that involved a lot of physical contact, which is not really what we do in our house. Like, we don't...
And again, that's part of the attraction, because
yeah,
they were
so
having
so much fun
playing tickle games with him in ways that we didn't do.
When the Barretts meet him, Jamie Treadwell has just moved back to Michigan from Europe, where he ran a program for at-risk youth. He's new in town, so he asked to join Rob Barrett and his family at their church in Grand Rapids.
I really felt honored that he would want to spend time with us. This amazing guy with all of this stuff going on has taken an interest in us.
Treadwell is part of a Christian brotherhood called the Servants of the Word. About 60 celibate men make up the Servants of the Word, living single for the Lord, as they put it. They live communally, share money and possessions. Home base is near Chelsea, Michigan, but the group has houses all over the world, including Grand Rapids. Treadwell transfers to that house in 2015. We will get to this group and what they knew about Jamie Treadwell in a bit. But first, back to the Barretts. One night, this is in May of 2016, Rob and Crystal and their daughters and Treadwell are sitting around the kitchen table. Treadwell turns to Crystal and says,
hey, Crystal, do you remember when we talked about how fun it would be for me to stay the night sometime? And in my head, I thought, no, we've never talked about how fun it would be for you to stay the night. I don't arrange sleepovers with adult men.
It is not unusual for the Barretts to have overnight guests. They lived overseas, so they have friends all over the world and family across the country who come stay in their guest room. But Treadwell only lives a mile and a half away.
And then my girls start saying, oh, that would be really fun. We can play these board games. We can do this. We can do that. And then he said, and, you know, it's my birthday on Saturday, and it would just be so much nicer to spend the time with you all than by myself. The brothers are out of town.
Crystal goes from feeling frustrated and confused to planning to make Treadwell homemade cinnamon rolls for his birthday. She cannot put her finger on what exactly she's anxious about. The night Treadwell stays over, Crystal sits up in bed, tells Rob, please, go sleep in the girls' room.
I was literally laying awake at night for hours on end thinking, this really seems like this guy is setting us up, like, to molest my kids. Like, this is what this feels like. And then the next thing in my head would be, but what if you're wrong? What if this isn't that? And your kids love him, and he loves them, and he loves being part of your family. And what if you're wrong? There's part of me now that's just like, oh, good grief. What if there was even a 20% chance this is what this was about? Like, these are your girls. But I felt like if I wasn't 100% sure, I couldn't say anything to anybody.
Rob sleeps in the girls' room that night. Nothing bad happens. Still, Crystal is on high alert. Then one Sunday in September 2016, something does happen that confirms Crystal's worst fears about Jamie Treadwell. He pops by after church, unannounced. Crystal is in the kitchen making lunch. Rob, the girls, and Treadwell are in the living room.
Rob comes into the kitchen to start setting the table because it's getting close to lunch being ready. And I looked up at him and I said, Rob, I'll take care of all this. I'll make the lunch and I'll set the table. Please don't leave him in the room alone with the girls.
Not even for a minute, she tells Rob. Watch him. So Rob returns to the living room. His younger daughter is perched on Treadwell's lap. She's playing a game on an iPad. Treadwell is watching her game too, but Rob notices Treadwell's rubbing his daughter's legs.
For some reason, that just struck me as going, that's a little weird.
In full view, Treadwell is rubbing this 8-year-old's upper thighs.
As he's doing that, then her legs spread apart for whatever reason, I don't know. And then his hand just reached over into her crotch and just rubbed twice. Right between her legs, and then casually moved away. And it was just, he's not looking, he's just doing whatever with her. And that was when my brain exploded.
The Barretts make several calls about Jamie Treadwell. To the police, yes. Rob's younger daughter doesn't remember Treadwell touching her inappropriately. His older daughter tells investigators Treadwell touched her breasts during tickle games. She hadn't mentioned it before because she thought it was an accident. The Barretts also contacted the leaders of the Servants of the Word, that celibate religious brotherhood Treadwell is a part of. Rob Barrett talks to the group's leaders on the phone several times. They even drive across the state to meet with the Barretts. Rob says they tell him,
you know, Jamie's been told by his lawyer, don't talk to anybody about anything. They spend time with him and they say he just sits there silent. He will not say a word.
They have a meeting, he says nothing. And they just talk and he says nothing.
Leaders of the group wouldn't talk to Michigan Radio. But in a series of emails and documents, one thing is clear. Parents have raised concerns about Jamie Treadwell before. Concerns that did reach someone at the Servants of the Word at least 10 years ago, long before he moved back to Michigan from Europe. East Grand Rapids police take the Barretts' complaint. They investigate. They want Treadwell charged with second-degree criminal sexual conduct. This is the part where you might think Jamie Treadwell is going to get arrested. But that's not what happens.
A lot of these cases do come down to some sort of corroborating evidence.
This is the Kent County prosecutor, Chris Becker. I interviewed him in September, 3 years after the Barretts case was referred to him for prosecution in 2016. Becker says there's just not enough evidence to prove the Barrett's case beyond a reasonable doubt.
You had the dad making essentially a disclosure saying he saw something, but his two daughters didn't back him up.
So just hours after the warrant request lands on his desk, Becker decides not to charge Treadwell.
Under sexual assault law, you know, prior instances of other sexual assaults or molestations are admissible. So those could play a role in swinging the balance, you know, towards charging if we have evidence of that.
If only Becker had more evidence, if only more victims had come forward, things might have worked out differently. I want you to remember this. We're going to come back to it. First, I want you to meet another family who says Treadwell also crossed the line with their daughter. Because that same summer of 2016, when Jamie Treadwell is hanging out with the Barretts, he's also making friends with another family in the Lansing area.
And he's like flipping Santa Claus. I mean, so fun. She thinks he's like the funnest guy ever.
This family is part of a religious group with strong ties to the celibate brotherhood that Treadwell is in. This family asked that we not use their names to protect their daughter's identity. Back in 2016, their daughter is 5. This dad hires Treadwell as a business coach, but they're social, too. And the way Treadwell builds that friendship will sound familiar. He invites himself over, there are tickle games and car washes, and he asks this family if he can stay overnight one weekend. He's got an art show in town. He shows up early, before dad's home from work. Mom is apologetic. She hasn't had time to get the sheets on his bed in the basement.
And then he looks at my daughter, puts his hands on his knees, and he says, "You want to help me make the bed? And don't worry about me. You go keep working on dinner." And like a fool, I do what I was told. I go upstairs back to the kitchen and start stirring a pot that's on the stove.
Upstairs, this mom has second thoughts about leaving her daughter in the basement with Jamie Treadwell. She feels a pit in her stomach when she gets back downstairs and sees him laying on the air mattress, spooning her daughter, rubbing her lower belly. This mom interrupts the spooning, crouches down to her daughter's level, and says,
"This basement door is Mr. Treadwell's bedroom door. He needs his privacy. When he is here, you are not to come down to the basement. You need to be upstairs the rest of the time."
Treadwell is silent. But when her husband comes home, mom doesn't get a chance to mention the spooning incident. It's hectic. She's busy cooking dinner, and then they all eat together. The whole family piles in the car and goes to Treadwell's art show. The next morning, dad's brushing his teeth when he hears Treadwell talking to someone in the kitchen.
"You know, it's my daughter. I assume it's her that he's talking to."
Dad hears the basement door open, so he peeks his head out of the bathroom.
"I'm like, okay, I heard him. I thought I heard her. And I definitely heard the door open and close to the basement and then go downstairs."
He opens the basement door. It's pitch black.
"I turn on the main light and I walk down the stairs and I start calling out my daughter's name.
No answer. So dad does a lap around the main area of the basement. Treadwell's room is off to the side. It's dark in there too.
I'm uncomfortable actually going into that room and turning on the light. Maybe he doesn't want to say anything because he's uncomfortable because he's in the middle of changing and I'm down there. Who knows, right?"
He calls his daughter's name a few more times. Still, nothing. So he goes back upstairs.
And I'm sitting there thinking to myself, he's definitely down there. Why didn't he say something? I'm almost positive she's down there as well. The fact that she didn't say something is very weird. So I go back downstairs. I do one more lap. And as I'm passing by his room, I reach in and I turn on the light. And I see him standing there looking gray, you know, hands at his sides, looking uncomfortable, a little sweaty, and she's in the bed with the sheets kind of half over her, and I don't know what to say.
Dad looks at his daughter and says,
It's time to go. Treadwell says nothing. This family also reports Jamie Treadwell to police. Their 5-year-old later tells investigators that she and Treadwell heard her dad calling, but they were playing hide and seek from her dad, that under the blankets, they told each other secrets. The police officer warns these parents, never let your children around Treadwell again. Here's the thing that drives me nuts about this case. The Kent County prosecutor, he didn't charge Treadwell in the East Grand Rapids case because there wasn't any corroborating evidence. Our reporting shows that's just not true. Here's what happens in the fall of 2016. This Lansing area family files a police report about Jamie Treadwell just 2 weeks after the Barretts filed their police report in East Grand Rapids. Officers from both police departments, they talk to each other. Police in both jurisdictions merge these two police reports to bolster the case against Jamie Treadwell. So when the Barretts report goes to the Kent County prosecutor, he has the Lansing area family's complaint too. I asked the prosecutor, Chris Becker, about this.
I don't recall a tangential report out of Lansing.
Becker says he never saw the other police report from the Lansing family back in 2016. Not until I pointed it out to him 3 years later.
When we reviewed it, there were some things about, you know, they had talked about he may have done it other places, but I don't recall seeing anything or looking at any sort of reports out of any other jurisdictions.
Now that he has seen it, Becker says he can always take another look. Quote, nothing is ever closed unless the statute of limitations has run on a case, he says in an email. That limit hasn't passed yet. Back in 2016, Treadwell refuses to talk to police. We wanted to get his side of the story. So this fall, I tracked him down to a church in Ann Arbor, follow him to a gas station in Dexter, tell him I need to talk to him about the Barretts.
This is kind of a bizarre conversation.
I don't think Treadwell is going to talk to me, so the audio quality on this windy day isn't great. Treadwell tells me he's heard that the Barretts have been stirring up rumors about him.
There's a terrible misunderstanding. I wish they would want to work with that, but as far as I can tell, they haven't contacted me.
Treadwell denies inappropriately touching the Barrett children. I ask him why he would repeatedly bring the Lansing family's 5-year-old into the basement. The mom says she made it clear she did not want her child down there.
They might have said that, but I didn't pick that up. So because that's what I'm saying. Okay, I just didn't see that.
And then he takes an unexpected turn. Treadwell places blame on this 5-year-old girl. Blames the Barretts for abusing his character.
Like, where's there any kind of human decency in this, you know, for someone in my situation? Because, I mean, you know that. You're a reporter. It absolutely destroys my life. It already has. I'm trying to find a way that I can be responsible to who I am and work in very different areas, but also learn from this.
Maybe God brought you into my life, he tells me. I'm Lindsay Smith, Michigan Radio News.
We've been listening to a story from Michigan Radio's Lindsay Smith, first aired in January, about Jamie Treadwell. Lindsay joins us now because this week brought several new developments. Lindsay, hi.
Hey.
Can you bring us up to speed on what you learned most recently about Jamie Treadwell?
Jamie Treadwell is currently at the Kent County Jail under $1 million bond, cash or surety. The Kent County prosecutor has now charged the Barretts case, and another complaint with a totally different family has come forward with a new complaint against Jamie Treadwell that happened the same year that the Barretts and this story really unfolded that you just heard.
What do you think changed police and prosecutors' view of his actions?
I think that having another family come forward in his jurisdiction in Kent County, this is a student at the Potter's House School where Jamie Treadwell was an artist in residence for about a year. I think having that new allegation in his jurisdiction really made the difference here.
Michigan Radio's Lindsay Smith. You can read her original story and the full update just filed this week about Jamie Treadwell at michiganradio.org. Lindsay, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
And that's our show for today.
I'm April Baer. Thanks for listening. We'll catch up with you on Wednesday.